This is Football in Europe.
Hello and welcome to the latest edition of Football in Europe. I'm Rob Daly. This is your weekly European football podcast. With me, back recovered from his own stag do, is Chris Parrott. Chris, what are we talking about this week?
Well, I wouldn't go as far to say recovered, Rob. 75% there, but plenty to talk about, although it was an international break, or still is. Another Dutch disaster, and they've changed their coach. We'll talk about the strength in depth that France have. Gigi Buffon has now played 1,000 competitive games, which is remarkable. And we'll also take a look ahead to the three biggest games this weekend once club football returns.
OK, very good indeed. And we're going to be hearing from Andrew Downey, the author of a brand new book about the Brazilian footballing legend Socrates. We're going to hear from Andrew later on. And if you follow our Twitter account, there's a competition to win a copy of his book, which sounds absolutely fascinating.
We have a prize, Rob.
Have a prize. Yeah, we don't do this too often, so get involved. You'll just have to, it'll be something on Twitter, a retweet or something like that, to be in with a chance of winning a copy of that book on Socrates. Highlights of the week in European football, you have been tweeting in. Mr. Walker Porter, friend of the show, has gone with Marcus Rashford's cameo against Lithuania. 30 minutes, 7 chances created, and 7 dribbles. Well, he did play a wonderful ball for Vardy in particular for an opportunity. Pete Farry says Delev's brace to beat the Dutch, which we'll talk about in a moment. And Gav says his highlight of the weekend is the fact there's no more internationals and we're heading back to club football. Well, we got friendlies in the week anyway, but don't be such a grump, Gav.
Well, actually, until June. But then by the time June comes around, because it's the only football, suddenly you look forward to the international.
Yeah. Break. Exactly.
But actually, I think we've mentioned this, but because almost everybody now qualifies for the European Championships, the World Cup is actually more entertaining, I think, because quite a few big teams always miss out because only the top team is guaranteed to go through. So therefore, you do have to be quite good to qualify for the World Cup, whereas all the stories in the European Championship, which was a great qualifying campaign for France, was all about who was going to finish third and fourth. So, as we'll discuss, the Dutch are an absolute disaster right now.
Well, actually, I was going to do this later, but I might as well do this now on this subject. Here's who's heading through from Europe, as things stand. So, obviously, Russia, as hosts, have already qualified. And 13 teams then qualify through the group stage. These group stages we're in at the moment from Europe.
Compared to 23 now for the European Championships, it's significantly less.
Exactly, much more jeopardy involved in qualifying. France, Switzerland, Germany, Serbia, Poland, England, Spain, Belgium, Croatia are all winning their groups at the moment. Iceland, Greece, Italy, Slovakia, the Republic of Ireland, Northern Ireland, Portugal and Sweden would all enter the playoffs and fight it out for 4 spots of the World Cup. Of the 9 runners-up in UEFA qualifying, only 8 end up in the playoffs. So as things stand, Montenegro, who have just 7 points to their name in Group E, even if they finish second, would not make the playoff stage. So there's that very thing that you're talking about there, Chris. Let's talk about a team that would absolutely love to finish second in their group, and surely that's the Netherlands, who have sacked on Sunday night Danny Blind after what many are calling a disastrous 18 months in charge, Chris. Why have they made the move?
Well, first of all, they've done it this week because they lost 2-0 away to Bulgaria and they sit fourth in their section. Yes, it's a difficult group. They're there with France, but they sit fourth. And because of what we're talking about, they're almost certain now not to go to Russia. And this comes off the back of them not going to Euro, you'll remember. So for the first time since 1986, the Netherlands are going to have missed 2 major tournaments in a row. I actually thought it would be longer than that, given what a wonderful footballing pedigree they have. But they weren't in France and they were missed. Their fans come in numbers. They're so vibrant in every way, including the colour of their shirts. And they're not going to be in Russia, barring an absolute miracle. It's not all Blint's fault. He took over from Gus Hiddink midway through their Euro qualifying campaign, couldn't resurrect it. And then this campaign has been equally as disastrous. And he has paid the price. What a wonderful player he was, but he hasn't cut it as a coach. And he goes. Fred Grimm is now in caretaker capacity whilst they look, I guess, for what's the word, a full-time guy to take over and maybe try and ensure that they get to the next European Championship. But Dutch football is in a right old mess, whether it be the club coefficient, which is way down the list, which we'll talk about later, and their national team, Rob. And such a shame for a country who were absolute shooies to qualify for every major tournament up until a couple of years ago.
I mean, there was scepticism about Blind's appointment when he took over from Hiddink, having been assistant to Hiddink during his very, very poor latest spell in charge of the Dutch national team. On Sunday morning, the Dutch newspaper De Telegraaf ran a poll asking their readers if Blind must resign after the defeat to Bulgaria. And 95% of readers said yes. I mean, even by online poll standards, that was an overwhelming opinion that Blind should not carry on as the Dutch head coach. And part of the focus around what's happening, Chris, is the decision to start about a player that Richard Connolly talked about on this show last week.
Yeah.
The 17-year-old Matthias de Ligt of Ajax.
Yes, who has made 5 starts, 2 in the league, which is remarkable for a 17-year-old. He then went and made a mistake, poor guy. Blind came out afterwards and said, was it a mistake? Yes, it was. Will I carry on? He basically said, I hope so. I think he must have known that the writing was on the wall. Because as soon as second spot seemed unachievable, I think they had to make a change. Why not? You know, you need to start building now for, you know, 2 years down the road to ensure you're definitely at the next European Championship. But yeah, I mean, it. What a sad indictment in a way that a 17-year-old who's barely played has a huge future. But to throw him in to that situation, you know, Blind was one of the greatest centre-backs, certainly that Netherlands have ever seen, and world football at the time. And he must have known. I don't think it's fair on De Ligt. And it's certainly an indication of the lack of depth that the Netherlands have, that a 17-year-old guy who's barely ever played suddenly comes in and is starting centre-half.
I mean, I remember Louis van Gaal obviously was the high point in recent years for the Netherlands, getting to third place in the World Cup in Brazil. But I remember van Gaal at Manchester United, an excuse he would often use for poor performances and poor results would be, well, yeah, OK, but I'm bringing through these young players, almost hiding behind the concept of bringing through youth to cover up the fact results were poor. And I wonder if Blind was trying to take a bit of a gamble here and do that and hide behind the fact that De Ligt was getting this big opportunity. It didn't pay off because De Ligt made a big mistake for the first goal for Spas Delev, who scored his first ever goal for the Bulgarian national team. He actually scored his first 2 ever goals for the Bulgarian national team, as he then scored a second after another poor header from De Ligt, who didn't clear the ball properly. So here's the situation the Dutch are in. They're 6 points behind France, 3 behind Sweden, Bulgaria 2. They're not ruling out appointing a foreign manager, and the campaign is salvageable, probably, Chris. Well, Fred Grim takes charge for the upcoming Italy friendly.
It is. I think you have to look at the bare facts, though. And I think if you go through the Dutch 11, certainly the one that started at the weekend, it's nowhere near as impressive as you might think, including myself. When I looked at it, you think, how are the Dutch doing so poorly?
Hold on, actually, but they've got Van Dijk, Strootman. I know he hauled off Wijnaldum, but Robben, Memphis Depay. Oh, there are good players in there. Quincy Promes, we see a lot of in Russia.
Yeah, no, good players, but how many of those players, aside from Arjen Robben? Now, this is twofold here. The Dutch should be good enough to finish as runners-up behind France in that group, definitely.
Yeah.
Okay, and that's why Blind has gone, because then you're in the playoff and you have every chance of making the final. But they have to overhaul Bulgaria and Sweden now. That's why it was such a damaging defeat, because it's not just Sweden they're battling with for second now. Bulgaria will fancy their chances of pipping both those nations to second. But only Arjen Robben is playing for a team left in the Champions League, I believe. And certainly only Arjen Robben is playing for what you'd call a super club, I think, a really top European team who are playing to somewhere near the peak of their powers. Okay, Strootman is impressing at Roma, Blind's at Man United. You mentioned Wijnaldum at Liverpool. None of those are Bayern or Real Madrid or Barcelona's. In the past, the Dutch would have had 3 or 4 players.
Very fair point, yeah.
Playing for top teams. So actually, there is a lack of talent, I think, in the Dutch side. They should be doing better than they are, but they shouldn't be absolute shooies for qualification. I don't think with their current team, and we have on the past with Richard Connolly, how low their national league is in the coefficient. I think it's down at 12th or 13th best European league. And ultimately, when quite a few of those guys who started in Bulgaria are playing for Dutch clubs, maybe we shouldn't be surprised when they lose to Bulgaria.
No.
You know, that's the way it is, and that is a bigger problem than Danny Blint or Gus Hiddink. You know, they have to find a solution, and they have to find it pretty quickly.
Follow the Football in Europe account on Audioboom for the latest podcasts, interviews and special features.
So Fred Grimm takes charge for now. He was the under-21 coach, was made Blint's assistant back in, I think it was September, the former Cambuur and Ajax goalkeeper who's mainly coached at youth level. I did check on Sky Bet, and Louis van Gaal's the favourite to take over. He did say he hasn't retired, but that's English bookies, so maybe a slight bias towards more conventional names. Chris, let's move on to France, because they got themselves a relatively comfortable victory. But there was also international debut, senior international debuts for left-back Benjamin Mendy. Benjamin Mendy, I should say.
Yes.
And Kylian Mbappe, both of Monaco.
Yeah, I mean, you say it was not particularly impressive performance. 3-1 win in Luxembourg. It was 1-1 for a time. They didn't get their third goal until after the 75th minute, but Deschamps' side still won. But, you know, we talk about a lack of depth in Dutch football. Well, you know, the France team is a bit ridiculous. Mbappe came off the bench. Gamero doesn't even get on, which is incredible given his form. And it's because Olivier Giroud is consistently performs in a France shirt. Now, my argument against Giroud for Arsenal and France consistently is that when it really matters, he's not quite good enough. And I maintain that. They didn't win Euro. They should have won Euro. Not that that was Olivier Giroud's fault, but you just wonder, Luxembourg away, is that not the time to pair Gamero and Griezmann together? They've been so good for Atleti. You know, are they going to win the World Cup with Giroud up front? I'm not sure. Might they win it with Gamero or Mbappe? Yeah, they might. Don't know, what do you think?
Well, Giroud, in his defence, is the top-scoring French international striker since the start of 2016. He has something like 10 goals. And actually, I thought, the final aside, when Deschamps realised that it was better not to have Griezmann out in a slightly uncomfortable position to have him paired with Giroud, that was when France looked at their best, at something he stumbled upon half-time, we'll remember, against the Republic of Ireland.
But he's got the option now with Gamero. That's my point. I totally take that.
Yeah, he does. Yeah.
And I just don't think Olivier Giroud is going to win France a World Cup. He might get them to the semi-final again. Gamero.
He did win a World Cup with Stefan Givarch.
Yes, they did. They also had a man called Zinedine Zidane in that side.
Yeah, they did. Yeah.
I just think surely Luxembourg away might be the time. I take that Giroud consistently scores when he plays for Les Bleus, but I think when it really comes to it, Gamero or Mbappe might win France a major championship. I don't think Giroud will.
Okay. Fair enough. And worth reminding listeners, no Lacazette, Ben Arfa, Anthony Modeste, the second top scorer in Germany this season, and Karim Benzema still in that France squad. Didier Deschamps refuses to talk about Benzema, who this week said he deserves an answer for why he's not in the national team. Well, we know why why that's happened initially. Belgium, they weren't very convincing at all. They got a 1-1 home draw with Greece. But they were without Eden Hazard and Kevin De Bruyne for only the second time since 2012. Lukaku with a brilliant late equaliser. And I think he is... Belgium have flirted with different strikers over the past few years under Mark Wilmot. I think Martinez is saying, no, Lukaku's the guy and we're going to build the team around him.
Yeah, definitely.
Speaking of more efficient international goal scorers than Romelu Lukaku, Cristiano Ronaldo, Chris, at it again for Portugal in a 3-0 win against Hungary.
Yes, he's now reached 70 goals, which is extraordinary. He got two. André Silva got another. European champions kept the pressure on Switzerland in that group. But yeah, Ronaldo's just... he keeps on scoring. Maybe not for Real Madrid as much, but still, at Portugal, he's that guy. I had a look at their team, by the way. It's that perfect mix of experience and youth. They look a serious side, I think, albeit... they're not necessarily guaranteed to finish top spot, so they might have to go through the playoffs.
In André Silva, as we've talked about, a guy we've talked about a lot on this show before, Portugal have a real striker who scored again. And between him and Ronaldo in their last five games, they've scored something like 14 goals or something, just something absolutely absurd. Silva got one against Hungary, Ronaldo got two, both long-range belters. And it puts Ronaldo, I mean, he's closing in on becoming the greatest European international goalscorer of all time. Puskas, 84 for Hungary. Kostis, 75 for Hungary. And Miroslav Klose, 71 for Germany. So he'll eclipse Klose and certainly be the greatest of the sort of modern era, if you like. I don't think he's going to catch Ali Daei, who scored 109 goals for Iran. Portugal, look at that team, Chris. André Gomes and João Mário haven't impressed this season particularly. They both started and were brought off. Renato Sanches wasn't even used. Mm. I mean, Fernando Santos, with 11 wins out of 12 games since he took over in qualifying, has a pretty strong, deep and young squad.
He does, mixed in with some older guys who have been there, done it, won everything, which is why I think they have a wonderful blend. It's interesting because you mentioned Gomes, Sanchez and João Mário. When we did speak in August, after Portugal had won Euro, those guys got big transfers to giant clubs, and really they haven't done much. Actually, they've sort of been the four guys, if you like. You know, Renato Sanchez getting in that Bayern team is extremely difficult, and he's very, very young. But you know, they are presumably only going to get better, albeit they haven't at club level performed as they would have hoped this season. Then you've got Bernardo Silva, who is, well, we've all seen how good he is for Monaco. They reached the final of the under-21s 2 years ago now. They were the best side. They lost on penalties to Sweden, but they were easily the best team. And they seem to have this generation coming through while still having Ronaldo, who's going to be their greatest ever player, still just about, or not just about good enough, but do you know what I mean? If it was a couple of years, you might say, well, Ronaldo's too much on the wane to almost get the most out of that young group. But if they can make it to Russia, which is still an if, things happen in playoffs, and Portugal have been in many an international playoff in the last few seasons or few years, I think they'll be contenders again. And they have that belief of winning now, don't they? Which you saw in the final against France, because they were second best, but they came out on top.
A lot of the time it's about that first win, as France and Spain have shown us, certainly since the turn of the century as well. OK, more from Chris in a moment. It's time to get our special guest on the show.
For more, head to the website footballineurope.co.uk.
OK, joining us now on Football in Europe is author Andrew Downey, who's put together a new book, Dr. Socrates, Footballer, Philosopher, Legend. Andrew, thank you so much for taking the time to come on Football in Europe.
No, thanks for inviting me.
I can't wait to get hold of your book, because some of the things I've read about it online, it just seems so interesting. And in particular, what a character Socrates was, because with a name like that, I suppose you were always going to be an all-encompassing figure in football.
Yeah, Socrates for me was the most revolutionary football player ever to kick a ball. And I say that for two reasons. One, he was, you know, a huge figure on the field because he was the captain of the Brazil team at the 1982 World Cup, which is one of the greatest teams never to win the tournament. But more important than that, off the field, he led a democracy movement in Brazil in 1982 at his club Corinthians. That was something that no other football player has really done before or since. He was a key figure in helping Brazil move from a right-wing military dictatorship towards democracy. And that really is unrivaled, and it really sets him apart from every other football player that I can think of.
Why was he such a politically involved figure?
That's a good question. And it really all happened for him when he came to Sao Paulo. He started his career at Botafogo of Ribeirão Preto, which is not the same Botafogo that some of your listeners might know. The Botafogo of Garrincha, Carlos Alberto Torres, Jairzinho and Gerson. That's the Botafogo of Rio. There's another Botafogo in the countryside outside Sao Paulo, and that's where he started. And he was a doctor. This is the other remarkable thing about Socrates. He started his career as a footballer at the same time as he was studying to be a doctor. So he would study during the day and he'd play football at night. And then it was something that you just couldn't do today, because the demands on modern footballers and modern doctors are just too high. But it really set him out in one way, because he never really trained, so he was always really skinny, and he never really had a, he was never really that strong or that, he never had the figure to withstand, you know, being cluttered from big defenders. And he said that his skill with the back pass, with the back heel, sorry, Pelé said he played better facing backwards than most players playing forwards. But that was because whenever the ball came to him, he tried to lay it off really quickly because he was worried he was going to get hit by big defenders.
Is it naive to say, I mean, part of my mythology around Socrates is that he wasn't, I mean, you described him as, he was a doctor there, but in my head, I think he was a smoker and perhaps not the most conventionally healthy footballer, even in, say, the 1980s.
That's right. And as you say, even in the 1980s, you know, where the standards were not so rigorous, and you see today, you know, you see a player gets caught smoking and he's hauled over the coals by his club and it's in the newspapers and it's a big deal. But back then, a lot of the players smoked. Junior smoked from the 1982 team. Batista, who played in the 1982 team. Serginho, I think, enjoyed a wee puff. So it was quite common back then. But Socrates, as with many things in his life, he took things to extremes. At his peak, he was smoking 40 a day. He was also a very big drinker. Because he lived in the in Sao Paulo, where it was really, really hot out in the countryside, he learned to drink from an early age, where they used the beer to hydrate themselves. So he lived life to the extremes, and he was this larger than life character.
I suppose the best way for people who were perhaps born before Socrates was playing, YouTube is the best way to find footage of him playing these days. But is there any kind of player you could compare him to now, Andrew, to give people an idea of? I mean, he was a very tall player, wasn't he, as well? I think in his sort of attacking midfield position.
Yeah, he was very tall. He was 6'4", and he was very skinny. And the best game to watch is obviously the Brazil 2-Italy 3 1982 World Cup match, where Brazil only needed to draw to qualify for the semi-finals, and they couldn't quite do it. It's seen as one of the greatest World Cup games of all time. Socrates, it's hard to compare him to other players, and I've thought about this quite a bit, and I kind of divide it up into three different areas, in off the field, off the field. On the field, he was kind of like, I describe him as a kind of Bobby Moore or a Billy McNeil kind of figure, as a captain, not as a player, as a captain. He had this, you know, quiet leadership. He wasn't a Brian Robson kind of figure who would charge around, shaking his fist and screaming at players. Players just respected him. He just had this aura about him. Off the field, he had this, you know, he had this hedonistic lifestyle. As I said, he smoked and he drank. And you could compare him to a George Best or a Garrincha. His life wasn't quite as chaotic as that. He married 4 times, had 6 kids. So he had that off-the-field lifestyle. But the big difference, as I said earlier, is what he did with politics and activism. And really, there's no other player that compares to what he did. He was that unique world-class footballer who was more important as an activist, more important off the field than he was on the field. But to get back to your question a little bit more firmly, he was an attacking midfielder come striker. He was compared to Tostão in the 1970 Brazil team in that he was a kind of false number nine before false number nines were a thing. He would come and go from the penalty box. He would create and he would score. He was quite languid. It's a position that doesn't really exist anymore because, you know that player who would play kind of behind the front two, the front three, who'd fit into the hole. It just doesn't really exist anymore. So it makes it hard to compare him to modern day players.
He ended up getting 60 caps for his country. And as you mentioned, 1982 was a tournament that many people would recognise him with. But back in Brazil, I think you live in Brazil, if I'm right as well, Andrew, is he more associated with his footballing exploits today, as he's remembered having died a few years ago, or is it for his political activism?
I think he's remembered a little bit more for his political activism. He is obviously remembered for that 1982 team, and everyone remembers the 1982 team, even though they never won. It's still Brazilians still I mean, they still have a special place for that team. I mean, they love that team probably more than the 1994 team that won, because the 1984 team kind of played ugly, they played to win, whereas Socrates always said the thing was playing good football, the thing was enjoying yourself, and that's what the 1982 team signified. But he's still a big hero at Corinthians, the club where he really made his name. He played with them from 1978 until 1984, and they're the biggest club in Sao Paulo, so he's really revered over there. I think, though, where, as I said, he transcended football, and so that took him to other clubs, it took him to other fans, and people identified with him because he was fighting their fight. He, in 1982, set up this Corinthians democracy, and he fought for the return of democracy, for the fall of the dictatorship. And that was something that went past football and club lines. And I think a lot of people remember him as somebody who stuck his head above the parapet, somebody who was not afraid to take responsibility, who was not afraid to risk his reputation and fight for an ideal. And that really resonated with a lot of people then, and it still resonates with a lot of people still.
I noticed that the foreword for your book was is from the late Johan Cruyff, and I wanted to know who else did you speak to try and get close to the idea of who Socrates was as a man?
Well, I did more than 100 interviews, so I spoke to, you know, mostly it was his family and his friends and football players who knew him. So off that famous 1982 team, I spoke to all the players bar one, all the starters bar one. So, I mean, Zico was helpful. Leandro was especially helpful at the start. Junior, the fullback, he was very helpful. A few of the players from 1986, particularly Casagrande, who some of you might not remember, but he played in the 1986 Brazil team. He also played for Porto and Torino and had a big drug problem and is now a well-known personality on Brazilian television. He was a real rock and roll footballer in every sense of the word. So they were all very helpful, and they gave me stories of Socrates, you know, as he was at the time, and I really couldn't have done the book if the players hadn't helped me, and if the friends and family hadn't come out with so many great stories.
I feel like I could ask you a million questions about him today, Andrew. A player who made so many appearances for Corinthians, and he also played for Fiorentina in Europe as well. But I have to ask, how did he end up playing one game for Garforth Town in West Yorkshire in 2004? But he must have been about 50 years old.
Yeah, he was 50 years old, and he got an offer from Garforth Town. The guy who ran Garforth Town was a guy called Simon Clifford, who ran a bunch of soccer schools. They were importing what's called Football de Salon, which is kind of like five-a-side football, right, for kids. It helps develop their skills. And Simon was a real go-getter. He was a real entrepreneur. And he had hired, if I remember correctly, he hired Lee Sharp to play for Garforth. And he had tried to get other big names, and he got Socrates. Socrates came to the UK and went around the UK with Simon promoting the soccer schools, and he was going to play for two or three games. But I think he got to Garforth, realised how absolutely bloody freezing it was, and thought, you know, screw this. He ended up only playing about 13 or 14 minutes of a 2-2 draw. So I think his value was more as a PR figure for the club, because everyone still remembers it, rather than anything he did off the field. But by that time he was quite old, and he wasn't very mobile. And if you can go and watch it on YouTube, and you can see him sitting on the bench, absolutely freezing his nuts off with gloves and scarf and hat, and it's pretty funny to watch.
Andrew, how can people get a hold of your book?
It's available on Amazon and Waterstones and online, and I hope it. Every good bookshop.
Dr. Socrates, footballer, philosopher, legend, is out now. Andrew Downey, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Great, thanks for inviting me.
Follow the Football in Europe account on Audioboom for the latest podcasts, interviews and special features.
And a big thanks to Andrew Downey for appearing on the podcast. Really appreciate it. Don't forget, if you want a chance of winning his book about Socrates, find out more on our Twitter account at FIE Podcast to be in with the chance of winning a copy of that book. Chris Parrott is with me. Chris, Gigi Buffon made his 1,000th senior appearance on Friday in a 2-0 win for Italy against Andorra. And of course, he had to keep a clean sheet.
He did. The 426th of his career. Remarkable. That is not my Rubin, though, Rob. So Gigi Buffon is 39, and that means that he is older than the other two goalkeepers in the latest Italy squad put together. Because Gianluigi Donnarumma is 18 and Alex Meret is 20. Those two, 38 between them, meaning that Gigi Buffon still has 12 months on them.
Oh, that's extraordinary. And an 18-year-old Donnarumma is set to make his first senior Italy start in a friendly against the Dutch in the week after having made a couple of sub-appearances, the AC Milan first-choice goalkeeper. A good win for Italy, a 2-0 success against Albania. Daniele De Rossi from the Sport Immobile with the second. They're set to go with a very young, experimental team against the Dutch in the week. But the game against Albania, there was a bit of crowd trouble as well. The game had to be stopped.
Yeah, it did. Some flares stemmed from the Albania supporters. So it was an interesting 1,000th game for Buffon. I mean, it's a while ago now on Friday, but it is still. Just take a moment to take it in. 1,000 games. Ridiculous. And he's going to get a few more, given that he's not retiring until after the World Cup next summer. But yeah, good win. That interesting as well. You mentioned about the friendly against the Netherlands, which is going to be very interesting, given what's happened with Dutch football, like we've discussed. I read some stuff from Ventura saying the main game in that group will be when they play Spain, but already talking about having to dissect his squad up for the under 21 championship this summer and how important that is for the future of Italian football. So who goes, who has a rest, things like that. Not just England that are going to have those problems when it comes to certain clubs saying, no, we don't want, you know, Donnarumma's 18, for example. So does he get his first taste of an international tournament? I don't know. It's you know, or to, presumably Milan don't want him to go. They want him to have a summer off, given how many games he's played at such a tender age.
A goalkeeper can do it, can't they? I mean, Jesus.
Well, I would say so. But it's, you know, you seem to have it every 2 years when the under-21s come up. But who goes, who doesn't? You know, you can see the argument now with Marcus Rashford. Does he go? Does he stay? Is he a senior international? Is he an under-21 international? I don't know. Tough one.
Certainly is. Italy going to experiment with a lot of their young players. Ventura saying that there's going to be a greater link between the under-21s and senior team going forward. Romagnoli and Regani, two young centre-backs at Milan and Juventus, set to start the game. Germany reverted to a more conventional team after their win against England. It was back to really their regular 11, bar the fact that Neuer was out injured. Bernd Leno in goal as Germany won 4-1 at Azerbaijan. Saw a bit of this game. André Schürrle, in his first start for the national team since 2015, scored two and made one. Mario Gomez and Thomas Müller, who the goals have dried up for, also got on the score sheet. Spain also won by that scoreline, Chris, with a 4-1 win against Israel. And it seems that Julen Lopetegui, who had a poor end to his reign at Porto and was criticised by the president there, is turning into quite a good fit for the Spanish national team.
You always thought he would, Rob, given how much he won at youth level. But yes, 4-1 against Israel, as you mentioned. Thiago Alcantara, after the game, admits Spain have more confidence under Lopetegui than they did at the end of Vicente del Bosque's reign. And it's interesting. It's quite similar to England, actually. And so we'll talk about Gareth Southgate in a moment. But basically, a lot of the Spain team now are guys who won the 2013 under-21 championship under Lopetegui. So it's Thiago, David De Gea, Dani Carvajal, Isco, Koke, Alvaro Morata. You know, all of those are now playing for top teams, which, you know, after Spain stumbled, let's be honest, in the summer, were disappointing in France. It does feel a bit like this conveyor belt of talent now. Lopetegui has them firing again. And, for once, it looks like the FA in England might just have followed what the successful countries do and have got a guy in who is young and is going to pick young and not just hungry players, but guys that he knew from working through the under 21. It's certainly very similar to what Spain have done with Lopetegui. I'm not saying England are anywhere as good as Spain, but it sort of bodes well instead of getting, in my opinion anyway, you know, some guy who has been there and done it at club level but has, you know, maybe never coached these players before.
I know what you mean. My one thing is whether they have... they obviously will know the players well, and a lot of the England players have spoken glowingly about Southgate and his personal relationships with them. It's whether they have the gravitas when things are going wrong. Yes. As in, you look at, you know, David Hayes in a dressing room with Jose Mourinho. You've got Danny Carvajal listening to Zinedine Zidane along with Isco every week. Koke's got Diego Simeone in his ear.
Yeah.
Thiago's got Carlo Ancelotti. And whether you go to Lopetegui, who has not succeeded at club level particularly, and whether that's still... I'm probably doing him a disservice there, but do you know what I mean? As in stature of someone as a coach.
I do, but every coach, I guess, has to start somewhere. And maybe the fact that they have those club managers in their ears means that they're winners when it comes to the national level, even if the coach might not be at this current time. I just think it's a much more exciting way of, and it seems to be the model that quite a few European clubs have, you know, and England haven't traditionally, and they have now. I'm not giving the FA too much credit because they rather stumbled across this. Let's be honest, they could have appointed Gareth Southgate in the summer, and they didn't, and they then had to parachute him in after Sam Allardyce's brief reign. But you know, maybe they have stumbled across something which might at least make England go to a tournament with an ounce of hope, even if we have it anyway and it's never really there.
An ounce of hope. Okay, some other notes from the qualifiers. Andorra got their first point in 11 years, having lost 58 games in a row. They drew 0-0 with the Faroe Islands. Northern Ireland got a commanding win over Norway, a 2-0 success. It was the first game in charge of Norway for Lars Lagerbäck, who was part of the Iceland setup at the Euros. I noticed that Norway had two of their senior international midfielders retire less than a month before that game, in Shellbred of Hertha and Alexander Tete of Norwich City. So just to gut the middle of your team before a huge game was a big blow for them. Robert Lewandowski scored his third free kick of the season as Poland won 2-1 at Montenegro. England, of course, 2-0 winners against Lithuania at Wembley. And because Ireland drew 0-0 with Wales, and of course the Neil Taylor tackle sort of overshadowed anything, and Seamus Coleman breaking his leg, Serbia won at Georgia, and that means they go to top of that section currently. I'm going to pick up the best friendlies really to keep an eye on this week. So the Dutch play Italy on Tuesday. Russia take on Belgium. That should be a very interesting game indeed. France face Spain, and the Republic of Ireland take on Iceland. I like the sound of that one. And Portugal take on Sweden as well. They're some of the best friendlies of the week.
How about Luxembourg against Cape Verde?
Well, what about it?
Call it off.
I tell you what, it's the only one that kicks off at 7 o'clock UK time. So you've got 45 minutes there.
Yeah, oh,
you might be watching the end of South Africa Angola.
No. There we go. You can watch the first half of South Africa Angola. Switch on for the first half of Luxembourg Cape Verde, and then take your pick. By the way, just to mention Russia here, they are. Have you seen how low down the FIFA world rankings? Which don't say everything, but they do say something. They're below 60 in the world a year
out. I don't get that. They just were at the Euros. I know they were poor.
They lost to some terrible teams in friendlies, and the way it works means that then you drop down. But, I mean, they're a year out from a home World Cup. That is a very, very tough task. I mean,
Sorry, Chris. I've just seen something. In the last few minutes at the time of recording, Ronald Koeman has ruled himself out for the Dutch job. He was obviously always going to be linked with the position, having been linked with Barcelona as well. But Koeman says, I think he's talked about wanting it eventually, but not now. Ronald Koeman not in the frame to be the next Dutch head coach. Let's do a bit of transfer silliness before picking out the games to watch next weekend. Lots of stuff here in Italy, across Spain, I should say, Chris. Lacazette heavily linked with Atletico. If that transfer ban is lifted for the next window, which is likely to be much like Real Madrid had theirs, Lacazette expected to join from Lyon. Barcelona, of course, with Coutinho hanging out with Neymar this week on international duty. He's been linked with Barcelona again. And Marca, over the past 48 hours, so 2 days, they've gone absolutely huge on Eden Hazard joining Real Madrid, and that Zinedine Zidane wants to bring him in and send James Rodriguez packing. Reports that head of recruitment of Real Madrid, Huni Kalafat, was at Stamford Bridge to see Chelsea 1, Manchester United 0 in the FA Cup relatively recently. Eden Hazard at Real Madrid, Chris.
First of all, the fact that somebody watched a match, even if it is a scout, it really is irrelevant because you get 20, 30 scouts at every game.
Agree on that, yeah.
Eden Hazard is a top player. Would he improve Real Madrid? Yes, I think he would. It's going to be very interesting to see what happens with Chelsea and Conte, because if you win the league and you're Abramovich, you're back in the Champions League. Do you want to lose your best player? And I say best, they have a team full of exceptional players. They might lose Costa this summer to China anyway. If they were to lose Costa and Hazard, what would that say? I don't know. I think it would take...
But this is the Real Madrid... This is the Real Madrid, Barcelona, Bayern problem that everyone else has. Because when these teams come in...
Yeah.
It's almost impossible to stop them
going. I think it would take... It might take a world record fee, potentially.
Yeah, I agree. Agree on that.
To get him. And from Chelsea's point of view, you do absolutely everything you can. I'd say more so than Costa to keep Hazard at the club. He's that guy that, you know, beats a man and suddenly the space opens up. And yes, he was very poor last season by his own, you know, admission. This season he's been back to his best. So no surprise that Real Madrid would like him. I'm fascinated to see where Romelu Lukaku goes, by the way. That's if Everton don't get Champions League football. That's not impossible.
I don't think they will. And I wondered if it was going to be... Because Diego Costa this week talked about how Atletico tried to re-sign him but took a little too long to get the deal through. And Simeone said, yes, it's true. And Simeone used these words this week. That Costa was their Messi in the 2014 season. I initially thought maybe we'd see Costa go to Atletico, we'd see Griezmann go to Manchester United and Lukaku head to Chelsea to replace Costa, if you like. But the Lacazette thing sort of... I think there's going to be a bit of a striker merry-go-round.
Yeah, I think Costa will go to China. I don't think he'll go to Atleti.
And I think, do you think?
And I think the fact that there's the new stadium means that probably Simeone and Griezmann will stay at Atletico. Otherwise, I just don't see Atletico's team being gutted this summer unless they were to win the Champions League. And then perhaps, you know, it might be...
Oh, yeah.
We've done everything. Okay. I think Costa will end up in China. And I think the Premier League is opening up a whole new subject. But sometimes we look at it and say, oh, isn't this outrageous? Diego Costa's dream when he grew up was not to necessarily live in London. There's no difference to him between living in London and living in Beijing. You know, some guy.
Yeah, there is.
No, I don't think there is. Some guy from Montevideo dreaming didn't dream up and think, I'd love to live in Swansea. They didn't. The Premier League, the Premier League happens to pay the biggest wages and is arguably the best league in the world, so people play there. But it's not like an English player moving to China. It's, you know, it's closer to home, if anything. It's still an awfully long way from Brazil and Uruguay. But you see what I mean? I think we get het up that finally another league has a spending power to match the Premier League, and people don't like it. But there's no reason why Diego Costa wouldn't move to Shanghai or Beijing.
Paulinho, by the way, scored a hat-trick for Brazil in their 4-1 win at Uruguay.
Did
qualifying.
He?
So moving to China hasn't done him any damage. Yeah. Yeah, and the coach he's working with now at Brazil was his coach at Corinthians, and he scored loads of goals when he was there.
There
so
we
I wonder
go.
If it's something to do with those two working it out. Okay, Chris, let's try and get through this in a couple of minutes. Games to watch this upcoming weekend. Schalke take on Dortmund in that huge derby in Germany. I think the best derby in the Bundesliga. Ajax take on Feyenoord. Ajax 6 points behind Feyenoord in second in the Eredivisie. If Ajax can beat them in Amsterdam, that gap goes to 3 points as Feyenoord look for their first title in a very long time. But my word, Napoli-Juventus, Chris, in Naples, this is the Higuain banger.
It's the one everyone's been waiting for. And we get two versions of it in a couple of days because they play each other in the Coppa Italia semi-final as well. But yes, Higuain back. I think to say he'll get the worst reception of any player is probably accurate in European football this week. It's going to be very loud, very aggressive, and you wouldn't put it past Higuain scoring, would you? In terms of practically in Serie A, I think it's one of the last remaining hurdles for Juve to clinch another Scudetto. If they can come away with a point or a win, it'll be a huge step closer towards retaining that title once more. I think it's going to be great. I think the atmosphere will be as good as it was maybe just before that Real Madrid game. And it's a huge match for Napoli as well. But yeah, it should be good. And tell you what, if Higuain scores, wow.
Well, he's scored in both games against Napoli already this season. He scored the winner in the league when the two sides met in Turin. He scored in the Coppa Italia semi-final first leg in Turin as well. A very controversial game in which Juve were awarded two penalties, Dybala scoring both of them. De Laurentiis, the Napoli president, was furious. The mayor of Naples even had his say, saying that we suffered continuous injustice against Juventus. It only adds to it. And then, so 3-1 is the Coppa Italia score, and they're going to try and turn that around in the second leg as well.
Yeah, exactly.
How these things work out. Okay, I think that's all we have time for, Chris, on the football in Europe. Been a good show, isn't it? We've rattled through the internationals.
We have, actually. I've got something to bring to the table.
Oh, I better not be boring.
Yeah, well, hang on. If I say to you coefficient...
Oh, Jesus. Okay.
No, this is good.
Let's have it. No, you love it. You love the coefficient. So let's have it.
Okay. First of all, I don't love the coefficient. It happens to be extremely important, though. So... here we go.
You're such a square.
I'm really not. My mathematical brain is terrible. So because of what happened in the last 16 of the Champions League and the Europa League, the top six countries in terms of their points are now confirmed. So nothing can happen between now and the end of the season to change the top six coefficients, which therefore impacts what happens in the 2018-19 season. So for the Champions League, Spain, Germany, England and Italy, we knew this already, will have four teams each guaranteed in the group stage. Gets interesting behind that. Portugal started this season as the fifth best league. They've had a disaster. They've now dropped out of the top six. France and Russia have overtaken them. That means France and Russia will have two teams guaranteed in the group stage and one in qualifying. So Russia, brilliant for them. One extra team in the Champions League group stage. Portugal have dropped to seventh, which means they'll only have one team guaranteed in the group stage. And you look back at big results now. Sporting losing to Legia and not making it through was key in Russia overtaking them. And one of the other reasons why this is so important is because of the change in the rules, it helps the big nations. So next season is massive for Portuguese football, because if they don't re-overtake Russia, by the time the new regulations come in, it will be very, very difficult to jump up in terms of countries. So Portugal might always only ever have one guaranteed entry, which for Porto and for Benfica and for Sporting would be a bit of a disaster.
I think I kept track of that. I think I just about kept up with you. Okay. So keep an eye on that for the rest of the season.
No.
Keep eye out for... What?
No. The rest of this season's now irrelevant. It's what happens.
Keep an eye out for it next season.
Yeah, next season. Keep an eye out for it.
Save that for the end of the season then.
Well, don't worry. We'll go back over it at the end of the season.
Oh, please. Okay.
We'll do a podcast special.
Please leave us a review on iTunes. Tweet us at FIU Podcast. Chris, see you next Monday.
See you next Monday.
This is Football in Europe.